Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles. Valentine's Day occurs every February the 14th, a day synonymous with the giving and receiving of gifts with the one you love. St. Valentine's Day as we know it today contains vestiges of both Christian and ancient Roman tradition. The origins of St. Valentine's Day lie shrouded in obscurity. St. Valentine himself, a 3rd century Roman martyr, seems to have nothing to do with the romantic traditions that became associated with his feast. The first mention of Valentine's Day traditions in England originate from the 14th century writers Geoffrey Chaucer and John Gower, who both allude to the folk belief that birds chose their mates on the feast of St. Valentine, their patron. In Britain, the mating flights of crows, rooks and ravens can generally be observed by February the 14th. Around 1440, John Lydgate's poem in honour of Queen Catherine, widow of Henry, is the first to mention romantic traditions among humans associated with this date. After the Reformation, the Feast of St. Valentine was abolished, and yet the amorous traditions flourished. The Catholic Church recognises at least 3 different saints named Valentine, all of whom were martyred. One legend contends that Valentine was a priest who served during the 3rd century in Rome, when Emperor Claudius II decided that single men made better soldiers than those with wives and families. He outlawed marriage for young men. Valentine, realizing the injustice of the decree, defied Claudius and continued to perform marriages for young lovers in secret. When Valentine's actions were discovered, Claudius ordered that he be put to death. Others insist that it was St. Valentine of Terni, a bishop who was the true namesake of the holiday. He too was beheaded by Claudius II outside Rome. Other stories suggest that Valentine may have been killed for attempting to help Christians escape harsh Roman prisons, where they were often beaten and tortured. According to one legend, an imprisoned Valentine actually sent the first Valentine greeting himself after he fell in love with a young girl, possibly his jailer's daughter, who visited him during his confinement. Before his death, it's alleged that he wrote her a letter signed, "From Your Valentine," an expression that's still in use today. While some believe that Valentine's Day is celebrated in the middle of February to commemorate the anniversary of Valentine's death or burial, which probably occurred around AD 270, others claim that the Christian Church may have decided to place St. Valentine's feast day in the middle of February in an effort to Christianise the pagan celebration of Lupercalia. Celebrated in February, Lupercalia was a fertility festival dedicated to the Roman god of agriculture, as well as to the Roman founders Romulus and Remus. Love is one of the most powerful human emotions, and with romance and Valentine's Day as a backdrop to today's podcast, let's celebrate the month of February and its association with love by taking a journey into some dark tales of murder, ghostly tales specific to the date itself, and explore hauntings and locations with love at the heart. Hauntings that demonstrate eternal devotion, eternal betrayal, or love just gone wrong. When you think about it, most ghost stories have elements of romance in them, don't they? Common ghost origin stories tend to run one of 3 ways. A murder or misdeed has been committed, an unjust, sudden or premature death occurred, or they died of a broken heart. Gertrude Treadwell, for example, was born in 1840 to a wealthy merchant family on East 4th Street in New York and would grow up to fall in love with a doctor by the name of Lewis Walton. Walton, however, was Catholic, and Gertrude's strict Episcopalian father forbade the marriage. She never loved again. Gertrude pined away on East 4th Street until she died in 1933. The Treadwell family lived in the house for nearly 100 years. Some say they never left. Many believe it is Gertrude Treadwell in particular who is watching over her family home. She's said to still wistfully haunt her old home, which is now a museum. Gertrude spent a lifetime loving one man. In her story, this is something she may even still do in death, a clear example of someone dying with a broken heart. When you listen to these next stories, judge for yourself which category they would fall: murder or misdeed, a sudden or premature death, or like Gertrude, suffering a broken heart. We begin in Cherry Hill, the stately mansion overlooking the Hudson River near Albany, New York. It was already 40 years old in 1827, when it sheltered a vibrant household of 17 people. They were aristocrats mostly of the Van Rensselaer and Lansing families. Among those living there was John Whipple, a young upstart who'd married Elsie Lansing, the erratic niece of Catherine Van Rensselaer. At least 5 servants, including itinerant worker Jessie Strang, were living in the basement rooms. Domestic tranquillity at Cherry Hill would be disrupted forever when Elsie and Jessie failed to observe the distinction between upstairs and downstairs. Elsie Whipple had a reputation for being hysterical and undisciplined. Her father had died when she was very young, and Elsie was raised and pampered by a mother and grandmother who had the same characteristics. At aged 14, she eloped with John Whipple, who lived next door. He was 9 years her senior. Elsie's grandfather, Captain Abraham Lansing, was livid. He'd given her father money and property that had now passed to Elsie and would be controlled by John Whipple. Captain Lansing viewed Whipple as a fortune hunter and went to court trying to get his gifts back, but lost the suit. Lansing died before there was any reconciliation, but the rest of the family eventually warmed to John Whipple. He was a shrewd businessman and grew his wife's inheritance into a small fortune. Living in one of the basement rooms of Cherry Hill was a workman who went by the name of Joseph Orton, called Doctor, by the rest of the household because he wore glasses and knew how to read and write. He did farm work, chopped wood, tended the stable and made general repairs to the house. His real name was Jesse Strang, and he had a wife and 4 children in Fishkill, New York, which he deserted in 1825. He moved to Sandusky, Ohio, then in the spring of 1826 to western New York, where Jesse Strang faked his own death and became Joseph Orton. Strang first saw Elsie Whipple when he was working at a tavern near Albany, owned by Otis Bates. Soon after, Strang went to work at Cherry Hill, and his amorous feelings for Elsie continued to grow. He would see her often, and they would sometimes talk, but he had no indication that she was interested in him. Then one day, Elsie told Strang to write her a letter and tell her his feelings. Strang was perplexed. He knew Elsie was married and did not want trouble, but he did not want to pass up the opportunity. And so began a series of daily love letters between the two. In their correspondence, Elsie expressed her willingness to flee with Strang. He was agreeable to this, but said they would need $1,200 to get established somewhere else. Elsie had a fortune worth much more than this, but by the laws of the time, it all belonged to her husband. She could not touch any of it while he was alive. And so Strang and Elsie decided that they could live together, only on John Whipple's death, and they were determined to make that happen. They made a pledge that neither would inform on the other, and if one were caught, the other would confess and they would hang together. In the spring of 1827, they began to take action. First, they tried poison. Strang bought some arsenic in Albany, and Elsie put it in a tonic that her husband took every day. She did not give him enough, and though it gave him stomach cramps, the poison did not kill him. Next, they thought of using a hitman, but they did not have the money. Finally, they decided that Strang would have to shoot Whipple himself. Elsie suggested he use one of her husband's dueling pistols, but Strang preferred rifles and bought a $25 flintlock. They spread rumours that some men were out to kill Whipple over a business matter. Strang said he'd seen strange men lurking around the house. On the evening of May 7th, 1827, Jesse Strang took off his coat and boots and climbed with the rifle onto the shed attached to the back of Cherry Hill. Standing in the dark, he could see into Whipple's window without being seen himself. John Whipple was in the room talking with another companion without a care in the world, oblivious to the danger outside, when Whipple stood up with his back to the window, Strang fired the rifle, hitting Whipple under his left arm. Strang jumped off the shed and ran into a ravine behind the house, where he buried the rifle. He put his coat and boots back on and returned to the house, where John Whipple was now dead. Strang was sent to fetch the coroner, and when he returned he was sworn in as a member of the coroner's jury. The next morning the jury convened, and though a member of it, Strang also gave evidence. He spoke vehemently about prowlers he'd seen outside the night before. But Strang had overplayed his hand, and his zeal to place the blame on the prowlers made the coroner suspicious. The following afternoon, Strang was arrested for murder. 2 weeks later, Elsie Whipple was arrested as well. In June, Jesse Strang confessed to the murder and told prosecutors where to find the rifle. He believed that if Elsie was convicted as well, her powerful family connections would get them both pardoned, and he tried to lay the blame on her. But when his lawyer and the prosecutor told him that nothing he said against Elsie would lighten his punishment, he withdrew his confession. Strang's trial generated intense excitement. The jury deliberated for 15 minutes before returning a verdict of guilty. Elsie's trial followed the same course as Strang's, except the prosecution tried to call Strang as a witness. There was much debate over his eligibility to testify, because he'd been convicted but not yet sentenced. In the end, the judge would not allow his testimony. The prosecution rested, and the jury, without leaving their seats, acquitted Elsie Whipple. An establishment had closed ranks to save one of their own from a public hanging. Between 30,000 and 40,000 people turned out on August the 24th, 1827, to witness the hanging of Jesse Strang. Cherry Hill is still standing and fully open to the public. It's said that the ghosts of John Whipple, Elsie and Strang all roam the halls of Cherry Hill. Witnesses have seen ghostly apparitions on the bottom floor of Cherry Hill, believed to be that of Mr. Whipple. Jesse Strang's spirit is often seen where the gallows once stood, wearing the same clothes he wore the day of his execution. Tragic love in this case ending with lingering ghosts. Before we head back to the podcast, if you haven't already visited the Haunted History Chronicles Patreon page, now is the perfect time to join, to listen and enjoy a multitude of additional podcasts, merchandise, mail and other written materials. It's a great way to support the podcast continue to grow and put out additional content, share guests and their stories, as well as helping the podcast continue to be enjoyed. You should be able to see goals the podcast is working towards to help see how your support contributes to this, and with different tiers you can help for as little as you like, and as long as you like. For the month of February there are going to be daily paranormal podcasts available to enjoy on most tiers, and signing up now will gain you access to these as well as all previous archived content. You can find the link in the episode description notes, as well as on the Haunted History Chronicles website. And remember, you can always help support guests and the podcast by coming and liking the social media pages and chatting over there. It's truly all very much appreciated. And now, let's head back to the podcast. Our next stories of hauntings see us visit England, and we begin in Longleat, which is the home to the ghostly apparition known as the Green Lady, and believed to be that of Lady Louisa Carteret, the Viscountess of Weymouth, who died tragically giving birth on Christmas Day in 1736, aged just 22. Local legend tells us that she had an affair with one of the household servants, a footman, and when this was discovered by her husband, the Viscount arranged for the man to be killed by having him thrown from a staircase. His body was buried secretly within the house or grounds. Lady Louisa never recovered from the disappearance, and believed her husband was responsible, and was holding him prisoner somewhere on the property. The loss and her highly emotional state clearly playing a part in her young death. She would engage in nightly searches trying to find him, on one occasion catching a chill which developed into pneumonia, an illness she would succumb to whilst giving birth. She's been seen gliding through the rooms and hallways of Longleat, wearing a flowing green dress. Even today she's heard banging on doors within the property. Maybe she's still searching for the man she had loved and lost. Evidence that may back the death of the footman and her story appeared in 1915, 180 years after her death. It had become necessary to undertake some renovations. Floors were needed to be lowered to accommodate pipes and a boiler. Whilst carrying out the work, the remains of an unidentified man were discovered beneath the staircase within the house. He appeared to be wearing the remains of jack boots and fragments of a uniform fitting that of a footman from that period. Perhaps these are the remains of her lost lover. Just a few hours' travel from Longleat, overlooking the Great Ouse River, is the old ferry boat of St. Ives, which can be found nestled in the sleepy hamlet of Holywell. Reported to be England's oldest pub, this has been a spot for weary and hungry travellers to stop for years. A heartbreaking tale of unrequited love, the ghost of Juliet Tewsley is rumoured to rise every year on the anniversary of her death and cause sleepless nights for guests at the inn. A previous manager at the pub has told his paranormal experiences, including tales of things that go bump in the night. The story begins on March the 17th, the year 1050. A local girl who was only 17 at the time fell passionately in love with a forester called Tom Zool. Sadly, Tom didn't return her love, and heartbroken, Juliet hung herself from a nearby tree that was near the inn, so that Tom could see her body on his way to work. In another version of the story, Juliet drowned herself in the River Ouse instead of hanging herself. Whatever the cause of her untimely death, suicides during the 11th century were denied burial in consecrated ground, and so Juliet was buried in the unhallowed ground close to the inn, her grave being marked simply with a plain stone slab. The slab can be seen in the bar today, and one that many try to avoid. Rumour has it that Juliet's ghostly form rises from the river at midnight on March the 17th every year and glides towards her grave. Staff report increased activity around this date also. Lights will flash on and off mysteriously and objects appear to move. Most of this activity stops if you call out to the spirit of Juliet and wish her good night. Many people claim to have seen the heartbroken phantom, while others have commented on the eerie feeling associated with the ancient pub, feelings that leave them with the impression that they're being watched. Our next tragic Valentine story is set on Valentine's Day itself. At midnight, on Thursday the 14th, 1867, two lovers in their early 20s stood on the bridge in Liverpool's Sefton Park. William Robert Dunstan and Alice Harwood would soon have to part ways. William was in fact being pressured by his stern middle-class parents into an engagement with a wealthy heiress named Judith. It was at this meeting that William told a tearful Alice that their three-year affair would have to come to an end for the sake of his future bride. Alice stood motionless on that bridge, staring into the water below, before finally turning and kissing her lover once, and with tears in her eyes and a trembling voice, asked for but one last favour. That 12 months from that date they would meet again on that bridge. Dead or alive, they would meet. The following year dragged by, and they would reunite once again on that bridge. It would be a different meeting this time. Alice was still deeply in love. William was now married and in love with his wife, an admission he laid out that night to the shock of Alice. She begged him as they parted for one final reunion at the bridge, again the following year. William was initially against such a further reunion. Alice sobbed and pleaded with him, reminding him of the old promises and vows they'd whispered to each other on that very bridge during their long affair. She promised it would be their last meeting, that she would never see him again, and accept that their love had ended. William reluctantly agreed for one further secret reunion. In February 1868, William was involved in a shooting accident, suffering a leg injury which left him unable to walk without the aid of crutches. He struggled unsteadily onto the bridge that February the 14th. He rested his crutches on the handrail and waited impatiently for Alice to arrive. At midnight, the clock in the distance began to strike. From the end of the bridge, Alice was suddenly visible. She began walking at a brisk pace towards him. He raised his arms to embrace her, but she showed no signs of stopping. His arms went right through her. Alice carried on walking, looking back just once and whispering, "Dead or alive?" Once she reached the end of the bridge, she disappeared from sight. The following day, William visited Alice's family, telling them of the strange encounter, looking for reassurance that all was well, most likely. Alice's parents looked at each other. Mrs. Harwood broke down and began to sob. The father then told William that his daughter had died from a fever the night before, shortly before midnight. The nurse attending her in her final hours heard her whisper over and over to herself the words, "Dead or alive," before finally taking her last breath. It is said that every year at midnight on February the 14th, that the lonely ghost of Alice Harwood is seen crossing that bridge in Sefton Park, still apparently hoping to meet her long-dead lover William. Once she has crossed, the lady vanishes. To finish this podcast, let's look at a Valentine story with a love of a different kind at its heart. Love of power and of money. The bloody events were one of many retaliatory actions between rival gangs. It would lead to a Valentine's Day massacre playing out on the streets of 1920s Chicago, shocking the city and forcing reforms and actions to be taken to tackle mob crime and violence. It was the beginning of the end for one of history's biggest mobsters. A light dusting of snow was falling on North Clark Street in Chicago the morning of February the 14th, 1929. Traffic was moving slowly. A black Cadillac would turn into the street. The driver and front passenger were both dressed in police uniform, including cap and badge. In the back seat were three men in civilian clothing. As they travelled down North Clark Street, they stopped in front of a building used as a garage and warehouse belonging to a shipping and packing company. Four men would climb out and head inside the garage. Inside the garage was the 35-year-old mechanic Johnny May and his dog Highball, which he'd tied to the axle of a truck he was repairing. Two brothers, Frank and Pete Gusenberg, were sat around a coffee pot, waiting for a hijacked delivery of alcohol to arrive. With them was Adam Hayes, a business college graduate who handled the gang's finances, and Al Weinschenk, or Gorilla as he was known for his heavy-set build. The sixth man there that day was Albert Kuchelik, whose real name was James Clark. Reinhard Schwimmer, the seventh man, had merely dropped in that day as he frequently did on the way to work. These seven men had no idea what was about to happen. They did not know that Al Capone had reached his limit and ordered from his Florida home the remaining North Street gang and George Moran, known as Bugs, to be taken out. All of this commotion had been seen and heard by the landlady of the rooming house opposite. Jeanette Landsman had seen the Cadillac pull up and stop, and the four men get out and go inside. She had no idea that morning that she was going to be witness to an unfolding crime. On that same cold morning of February the 14th, Bugs Moran was off to a late start, having only left his apartment a little after 10:30 a.m. He made his way to North Clark Street, where he was to meet with the other men that were gathered there that morning. Moran and his driving companion arrived to see the same black Cadillac parked outside, and assuming that a police raid was underway, hurried down the street to park and wait things out in a coffee shop. From the second floor, Mrs. Landsman suddenly heard a peculiar and repetitive burst of bangs that lasted well over a minute. Two loud blasts would follow before the street settled back into silence. The only sound now the strained howling of a dog. From a window, she would witness four men reappear. Two with their arms raised, two men behind were dressed in uniform and holding guns to the backs of the men in front. Witnessing this, she assumed there'd been a police raid, and two men had been arrested, and so carried on her mourning. From the garage, the dog continued its pained, distraught howling. After some time, Mrs. Landsman, who'd become increasingly uneasy, asked a tenant named C.L. McAllister to check the building. McAllister didn't stay inside for long. He returned quickly, visibly shaken and crying out, "The place is full of dead men." Only one man survived the initial slaughter, and he never spoke a word of what had happened. That man was Frank Gussenberg. He was riddled with 14 bullets, but had managed to crawl 20 feet from the rear wall. The others lay dead where they'd fallen at the foot of the wall, a wall now splashed with blood, growing pools of it running across the floor. They'd been murdered with cold, brutal savagery, their bodies riddled with bullets from Tommy guns swinging back and forth in calculated precision. Johnny May and James Clark had both been finished off with shotgun blasts fired at close range. 70 shell casings littered the floor. Still tethered to the axle, Eyeball pulled and howled. The area was soon swarming with police. Frank Gussenberg was taken to hospital, where 3 hours later he would die from his wounds. No one was arrested for the crimes that day. The brutality of the massacre shocked the public, though, and given that prior to this there'd been 64 mob-related crimes in that year alone, a cry for action was called for. The police were put under increasing pressure to take action and end the violence. Capone was labelled the largest threat and became a target, the subject of multiple federal investigations that would eventually lead to his arrest. North Clark Street became a local tourist attraction for enthusiasts intrigued by the story. Over the next few years, the building would be occupied by different owners and used for different purposes, before finally being demolished in 1967. The bricks purchased by Canadian businessman George Patey to be used as an attraction in a travelling crime show. For many years, people living nearby or walking along the street report hearing the sounds of muffled voices, screams, moans, and even the firing of a Tommy gun. Residents living opposite where the building once stood would report knocks on their doors and hearing strange voices outside. If they opened their doors, nobody would be there. They could never find an answer for the other sounds they heard at night. They never saw anything of flesh and bone to account for it. What was seen was a dark, shadowy figure that would fade away. Today, the site of the massacre seems like any other piece of land, a vacant lot except for lots of trees nestled between an apartment building and a retirement centre. This seems like any other place in Lincoln Park, unless you know its dark history. Love is most definitely a strong emotion, in all its varieties. Even love not of flesh and bone, but of power and status. Love can make people do terrible things and suffer anguish and hardship. It can also leave us with terrifying legends and tales of hauntings that endure through the centuries. Love can leave an enduring mark, sometimes even in death. Thank you for listening. See you next time. Bye for now. If you like this podcast, there's a number of things you can do. Come and join us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Spread the word about us with friends and family. Leave a review on our website or other podcast platforms. To support the podcast further, why not head on over to join us on Patreon, where you can sign up to gain a library of additional material and recordings, and in the process know you're helping the podcast continue to put out more content. On a final note, if you haven't read it already, then you can find my piece In Search of the Medieval in Volume 3 of The Feminine Macabre over on spookeats.com or via Amazon. Links to the book will also be in the episode description. Thank you everyone for your amazing support.